Garden Basics with Farmer Fred is brought to you by Smart Pots, the original lightweight, long-lasting fabric plant container. It's made in the USA. Visit smartpots.com/Fred for more information and a special discount. That's smartpots.com/Fred. Welcome to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. If you're just a beginning gardener or you want good gardening information, well, you've come to the right spot. One gardening trend that is beginning to take hold throughout the country is reducing the size of your existing lawn. What is our attraction to lawns in the first place? We talk with author Thomas Mickey. He wrote the book America's Romance with the English Garden, so that might just be the first clue to the answer of our question. Retired college horticulture professor Debbie Flower discusses a nasty weed, especially disliked by barefoot children and mountain bikers, puncture vine. And the University of California Davis Arboretum and Public Garden Superintendent Emeritus Warren Roberts tells us about an outstanding, widely planted tree for fall color, the sweet gum, also known as the liquid amber tree. But it certainly has its drawbacks, and I will gladly be the devil's advocate on this one. It's our plant of the week. Podcasting from Barking Dog Studios here in the beautiful Abutilon Jungle in suburban Purgatory, it's episode 154 of the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast, brought to you today by Smart Pots and Dave Wilson Nursery. And we'll do it all in just a little over 30 minutes. Let's go. Why do we have to have a lawn? What is it about our DNA or whatever that makes us want to have a lawn? Just so happens there is a book written on that very subject. The book is called America's Romance with the English Garden. The author is Thomas Mickey. Thomas Mickey, a pleasure talking with you.
Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Let's talk about the basis of your book, and I think I can sum it up pretty succinctly, is that we are swayed by advertising.
We certainly are, and the advertising that was operating in the 19th century when gardens were taking off in this country, especially with suburbs, was very powerful because it gave illustrations of what kind of garden you needed to have, and that illustration became the advertising, and that illustration included, of course, the front lawn, which we inherited from the English Romantic garden style.
I love the references in the book, too, about how the advertising in the 19th century, and basically that was almost one of the few areas of entertainment for people, was getting garden catalogs in the mail for these new homeowners in the 19th century. And the catalogs really stressed that you can make your life so much better if you just had this plant or this lawn.
Right. It was a very clever kind of marketing. And, of course, people didn't have much illustration, much marketing of any sort. So coming that kind of marketing coming in the catalog was really a powerful sway to buy certain plants and certain seeds.
And it was really empowering in many ways, too, because those advertisers were very aware of the growing women's movement. And so they had a lot of pictures of women with lawnmowers.
Exactly, exactly. And the catalogs were written for women. Women were the major audience for the catalog. But whenever they showed a woman in the catalog, this is kind of an interesting thing because I looked at many catalogs, the woman was always just in her Sunday best, upper middle class kind of figure, who was simply cutting flowers in the garden, really never working in the garden. It's almost as if you could have a garden with no work. It was kind of funny that way.
Or Martha Stewart.
Okay. Martha Stewart, the same thing, an enormous spread of gardens on her property, but she has lots of gardeners working for her, of course.
Must be nice.
Exactly, exactly. And that's really how the old English gardens were. They had these teams of gardeners who would take care of these enormous lawns. So when that idea came into the United States in the 19th century, the idea of having lawns way before the Civil War, the lawns were first established on these big estates outside large cities, especially on the East Coast. And then eventually, when people moved to the suburbs, the lawn became important for them. And of course, they had to take care of it.
Now, what was the reasoning for that lawn? I have a funny feeling that this had more to do with our own history and the way the rich people lived back in the old country.
Exactly, exactly. So that the lawn became a kind of a status symbol. People people who had lawns were of upper class status, and so if you had a lawn, it kind of connected you to them in a certain way. And so when real estate agents would try to sell a property in the suburbs, they would always say, now you could have an area in front of your house for your lawn, just like the big estates do. It's very powerful.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, that back in the old days in England, one way to flaunt your wealth was to have acres of turf to show your neighbors that I don't need to put that area under cultivation for food. I'm so rich.
Correct. And so it became a park in many sense, just like we would define a park today, these long, expansive lawns. And of course, on those properties, they had a kitchen garden hidden behind the house, walled in with a high red brick wall that would be used for the vegetable needs and, you know, and medicine and herbs and so forth.
Now, I don't want to give people the total idea that all your book is about lawns, because there is a wealth of information about a lot of plants that we've adapted here, that were popular in England. And unfortunately, we see that trend here in California, where the weather is very different than the weather on the East Coast or in England, and trying to emulate that English garden. And now with the drought happening here, people are finally starting to open their eyes to other alternatives. But again, advertising is swaying people.
Exactly. And certainly we have a lot of it going on today for all kinds of fertilizers and grass seed that you can use to have a beautiful lawn. It's still an important issue for a lot of people all around the country. But I must say, in California, there's a great historian, garden historian, whose name is Thomas Brown, and he wrote that California's plants in the 19th century, the major plants were the same varieties that were grown on the East Coast. In other words, the garden industry shipped a lot of the plants that were popular here on the East Coast to California in the 19th century. He says 95% of the plants were introduced species before 1900.
I am not a bit surprised. California is a land of immigrants, and you want to bring a piece of where you used to live with you, and what better than some plants?
Exactly.
So that makes a lot of sense. Now, let's talk about those seed catalogs that came out back in or the history of seed catalog. How long have seed catalogs been around?
Well, the catalog itself really dates from the early 1800s, but the catalog at that time was just a listing of plants, just like we would see one right after the other. But by 1850, when printing improved, and after that, when chromolithography and the press was able to create catalogs in the thousands, became a different catalog. So at that time, there were many seed companies, and they would not only have the plant listed, but also a description of the plant and also how to grow the plant. So there was more space to do that simply because you could print more. So by the end of the 19th century, the catalogs became like a little book. They had beautiful color covers and inside sometimes even color illustrations. And those illustrations done in chromo are really just as beautiful today as they were when they were first put in. So they were sent out in enormous amounts. For example, the Childs Company, which was in New York in 1875, sent out 750 catalogs. But 20 years later, 1895, they sent out almost 1.5 million.
Now, were these purchased by the homeowners, or were they sent out free?
They were usually sent out free, and then you became, as of course, a great marketing ploy, you became one of their numbers, so you would get one automatically the next year.
Just like it is today.
Exactly how it is today. And these seed companies were way ahead of other companies who were using the mail to sell their product, way ahead of Sears and Montgomery Ward. The seed companies kind of set the mark for all of that because they did such a great job at it. And these are relatively small catalogs to send around, and they did really well, especially when the railroad came out and then the government loosened up on post office regulations, and so these catalogs really were distributed clear across the country from Maine to California.
What catalogs now catch your eye and you look at them and you go, this is really good?
Well, the Cadillac of all catalogs today is the White Flower Farm from Connecticut. That's one of the most beautiful catalogs. a song sparrow catalog from the Midwest is a beautiful catalog. There are several catalogs for heirloom seeds that are really beautiful today as well. But a lot of the catalogs that we receive today are also online, so people aren't always printing them today. But we certainly have access to descriptions of the plants, either online or still in these old catalogs.
Yeah,
we still get a bunch of catalogs every year.
Now, one of the prettiest, speaking of heirloom catalogs, is the Baker Creek catalog, which is an oversized publication. It looks like a double issue of Life magazine, and just festooned with great color pictures and great stories about the plants. And really, that's part of a great garden catalog, are the stories of the plants.
Exactly. People love stories. You're right. And that's a great way for people to kind of connect with the plant, but through a story about them. That's a beautiful catalog, and it is an enormous catalog. You're right on that level, that's for sure. But Burpee, one of the famous seed catalog owners and seed company owners, W. Attlee Burpee, said, "The catalog is my salesman." Wasn't that brilliant?
Yes, and that's exactly true.
Exactly. That is how the person knows the company. So it was really a great marketing strategy, that the catalog is my link to the customer. And so I've got to do a good job at this catalog. And, of course, Murphy and the others did. They really were quite proud of that catalog.
It's been a pleasure talking with Thomas J. Mickey, author of the book America's Romance with the English Garden. Visit his website, too, AmericanGardening.net, and read his blogs. Excellent, entertaining writing there.
Thank you, Fred. I enjoyed it.
Smart Pots, it's the original award-winning fabric planter. It's sold worldwide, and Smart Pots are proudly made 100% in the USA. Smart Pots, by the way, are BPA-free with no risk of chemicals leaching into your soil, your herbs, vegetables, and other edibles. That's why organic growers prefer Smart Pots, and they last for years. Some gardeners have been using the same Smart Pots for over a decade. Smart Pot's breathable fabric creates a healthy root structure for plants. Because the fabric breathes, Smart Pots are better suited than plastic pots, especially for really hot and really cold climates. And unlike a plastic pot, the fabric won't crack or break from frost or when dropped. For more information, visit smartpots.com/Fred. And don't forget that slash Fred part, because on that page are details of discounts when you buy Smart Pots at Amazon. Visit smartpots.com/Fred. A while back when we were talking about controlling nut grass here on the Garden Basics podcast, many of you had other ideas about what is the worst weed to have. And I thank you for your submissions to the Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page on that topic. Debbie Flower is here, our favorite retired college horticultural professor. We had a lot of nominees for the worst weed to have. If you're a bicyclist, this may be at the top of the list. Goathead, a.k.a. puncture vine, with this really sharp seed case that will penetrate into your shoe sole, your tractor tires, and your bicycle tires.
Yes, yes. My experience with it was when I lived in the Reno area, and my kids were young, and they'd go ride their bicycle down to the school playground, and often they walked their bicycle home because they had run over one of those seed pods, and it had punctured the tire.
This is a tough weed to control in its early stages until you learn what it looks like in its pre-goathead stage, because it's a crawling weed. It sprawls. Mm-hmm. It's kind of green, almost looks kind of like an oxalis or something like that. But these seed heads are also known as caltrops. And the seed case resembles, it has like four spikes on it. And it can rest on any of the three spikes, and the fourth spike will stick straight up. And that means if you're trying to remove it, you better wear some good gloves.
Yeah.
Because they are sharp.
And they just sort of grow out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. They like a dry climate. Right. They're native to a lot of Mediterranean areas. They can't take too much in the way of freezing temperatures. But man, oh man, you do not want to be running barefoot through the daisies with this one.
No. Or riding your bike through the school playground.
Yeah, or mountain biking or any place where it may be, and because you're not going to see it.
It's very low, yeah.
Yeah.
Has a lovely little yellow flower and with five petals. From that flower comes that caltrop, that very sharp seed pod.
Now, the good news is there are two weevils that we've imported from India, France, and Italy as biocontrol agents. And it's a seed weevil that deposits its eggs in the immature burr or flower bud, and the larvae feed on and destroy the seeds before they pupate and emerge as adults, disperse, and start the cycle over again. The generation time in warmer areas is about 2 weeks, 3 weeks or so. But the stem weevil is just a helper. It's not going to solve the problem.
Right. It's not going to get rid of it totally. Now, you can get the weevils from an insectary.
Oh, can you? Oh.
There are such things as insectaries. And the one I like the best is called Rincon Vitova, R-I-N-C-O-N. And a second word, Vitova, V-I-T-O-V-A. And I like them because they want to talk to you about what's going on. And they want a lot of data about what you're trying to control. And they will keep in touch and mail you the appropriate biological control, insect in this case, when it should be released in your environment.
Their website is easy to remember. It's rinconvitova.com. And they're based here in California, and they have all sorts of beneficial insects that might help you out. That must be an interesting catalog to look at.
I've only looked at things online, and there's zillions of tables of what they have and what it will control and when it has to be released. When I worked with them for releasing some insects into the greenhouse to control other insects, they wanted lots of data like the humidity and the temperature extremes and things like that. So they, you know, and if you can't tell them, you say that, but they will work with as much data as you can give them so that you have the most success. A friend of mine had a barn with horses, and the horse manure attracted flies, and she got on a program through Rincon Vitova where they would send, I believe it was nematodes, to put in the pile that would eat the fly eggs.
Okay. I would think, though, for controlling the puncture vine, you would have to let the puncture vine grow for these weevils to do their job.
Right. You have to have that stem.
Yeah. Can you cut off the flowers and still be able to attract the weevils, or do they need the flower?
Right. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. And I wonder if you need to talk to your municipality about releasing an insect like that into the environment before you do it. So your government, but people with large properties may find weevil control helpful.
Yeah. But again, for management, and the good news is the seed can only live undisturbed for 5 years.
Right.
Unlike some seeds like Bermuda grass and others that can last decades.
Right.
So that's somewhat good news there. And in my experience, working with puncture vine, that if you get in there and remove it with your hoe, shallow tilling, generally, you might be free of that plant for a few years.
Right. It's a late spring, early summer germinator. So that would be the time that you would want to do that physical elimination of it. And that's when you're going to need to know what it looks like.
So we'll have those pictures posted in the Garden Basics newsletter for you to check out. Don't try mowing it, because A, it's going to get in the tires of your mower. And B, it's a clever plant. It will set flowers below your mower blade height.
Yes, it will.
Yeah. There's a few other weeds that do that, too.
Yes, yes.
So one of the tricks of working with it, and as I said, because of those caltrops, those very sharp goat head type seed cases, is you want to protect yourself. Take out a kneeling pad, heavy gloves. Another trick that one farm advisor told me about is use an old piece of carpet. And put it down in the area where you're removing it, and those caltrops, those seed balls, will stick to the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And then find somebody you don't like to remove them from the carpet.
Yeah, it better be carpet you don't want to keep.
Yeah, or toss the carpet, yeah.
But if you have animals, you know, that they will potentially get it in their fur and move it from place to place. The caltrop acts as part of its seed dispersal mechanism.
Right. We had instances of puncture vine on some of the walking trails around here, and the dogs were getting it in their paws.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah. And removing them is no easy feat, so to speak, because of the shape of that multi-pronged.
Curved, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, anyway, it's nasty. But if you can screen out light, that will work too. So again, it's a plant that doesn't like shade.
Mm-hmm.
It likes dry areas.
Yes, hot, dry areas.
Yeah. So if you see a weed growing and it's green and you wonder, well, how is this living
in this hot, dry area?
Yeah, you might take a closer look at it. And it could very easily be that puncture vine. It's obviously a plant that will withstand the next nuclear holocaust. What about chemical controls for controlling a puncture vine? You know, they say glyphosate can kill anything, but...
This is an annual weed, and yeah. So it's not... by the time it works, glyphosate does not kill something instantly. It will continue to grow, continue to produce whatever the next part is. It might be deformed, but hasn't proven to be very effective in getting rid of this plant over time.
And it's more effective the smaller or younger the plant is, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so there's that. And there are pre-emergent herbicides, but they're not that effective. They must be applied prior to germination, like you think there's going
to
be puncture vine.
You have to know
there.
It's going to be. Yeah. So if you've had the problem in the past, that might be effective, but otherwise, no.
Goat heads, puncture vine. I don't like it.
Neither.
All right. Thank you, Debbie.
You're welcome, Fred.
If you're thinking of growing fruit trees, or maybe you already have your own backyard full of fruit trees, well, you probably have a million questions. Like, which fruit trees will grow well where I live? What are the tastiest fruits to grow? How do I care for them? What are the most important things to know when starting a backyard orchard? Well, the good news is those answers are just a click away with the informative videos that you can find at DaveWilson.com. That's Dave Wilson Nursery, the nation's largest grower of fruit trees for the backyard garden. At DaveWilson.com, you'll also find planting tips, taste test results, fruit variety recommendations, and links to nurseries in your area that carry Dave Wilson fruit trees. Your harvest to better health begins at DaveWilson.com. Because there are so many demands on your time these days, well, I like to keep the Garden Basics podcast to under 30 minutes. But still, there's a lot more to tackle on all the garden subjects we bring up on the podcast. So for that and a lot more, we're starting up the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred newsletter. It'll be on Substack. It'll go into more details about what you just heard on the latest podcast. So, yes, it will be a good supplement for the Garden Basics podcast, but there'll be a lot more garden-related material and, you know, probably pictures of my dogs and cats as well. It's the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred newsletter. It's on Substack. And best of all, it's free. There's a link in today's show notes, or just go to Substack.com and do a search for the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred. That's Substack.com. The Garden Basics with Farmer Fred newsletter. Did I tell you it's free? It's free. Every week we like to talk with Warren Roberts out at the UC Davis Arboretum and Public Garden and get a plant of the week, always something that's putting on some sort of show despite the season. And today, Warren, we're talking about, well, it's a mixed bag of a tree, I must say, but it does have a beautiful fall color if you're lucky enough to have a variety that produces fall color.
We're talking about the liquid ambar, I think.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
The sweet gum, as we call it in the USA and Canada. Liquid ambar, LIQUIDAMBAR. Styracifluia is the species native to eastern North America. And continuing down, populations clear into Central America, incidentally.
Wow.
But I think the furthest north it gets natural grows is, I think, New Jersey. It's not the most cold-hardy tree, but it's certainly, for American trees, for fall color, it's one of the champions. And it's been widely planted in the West. I remember flying into the Burbank Airport in Los Angeles, looking out the window in the fall and seeing amazing fall color. This would have been the San Fernando Valley because of the hundreds, if not thousands, of sweet gums planted. There's one particular cultivar called Palo Alto, named for a tree growing in the town of Palo Alto in California, of course, planted here, which had dependable red fall color. But the fall color can be all the way from pale yellow through orange to red to purple red, mm-hmm. depending on the cultivar. And there are about 48 named cultivars. You have a lot of choice. The liquid ambar styracifluia is, they've changed the family on it. It used to be in the Hamamelidaceae.
I'm glad you said that and not me.
That particular family. Now it's in the Altingiaceae, which is a related family, obviously. So we don't usually worry about that too much when we're gardening, but that may be of interest to some.
It complicates my life when doing the transcript.
Oh, goodness. Altingiaceae, A-L-T-I-N-G-I-A-C-E-A.
You read my mind.
Of course, the leaves are beautiful. They look kind of like maple leaves, but they're born all opposite each other on a stem, whereas maple leaves are born alternately. Use that as a determining a way of telling one from the other. Also, when you crush the leaves of lichenambar, it has a kind of a carrot-like smell.
Hmm.
Nice, which the maple, of course, does not. So we have so many different choices for color. But there are several other species, some of which are available in the horticultural trade. And one of them would be lichenambar formosana, which is from China, and by the name you can tell also from the island of Taiwan. And this also has been in cultivation. I think there are four different cultivars. There is also a variety that's a little more cold hardy called variety Monticola, meaning from the mountains. This lichenambar has three lobes typically, and the cultivars that are available have kind of rosy red fall color. It's an attractive tree, and the burrs look more, are not quite as, when I say burr, I mean the fruiting heads, the seed heads, are not quite as hard and painful to sit down on the lawn.
Or your barefoot.
Oh, you're barefoot. Yeah, the Taiwan lichenambars, which is what I usually call, the burrs are softer. Now, there is another one, Lichenambar orientalis, native to the eastern Mediterranean region.
These are the names that confuse me. How an oriental sweet gum is from Turkey and not from China?
Well, the Orient in the Roman Empire was Asia Minor, of course, by association extending further east. Like the Orient Express went from where? Vienna to
Istanbul.
To Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was the Orient.
Yeah. Okay.
The Oriental Roman Empire, when they moved it to Constantinople. So this tree is native to that area. It's also native to the Holy Land historically. The sap is tapped on all of these species and used medicinally.
Hmm.
And this is. Lichenambar orientalis is the true biblical balm of Gilead, which people that read the Bible will come across that.
Or if you're planting a Bible garden.
If you're planting a biblical garden, a Lichenambar orientalis should be one of your main trees.
Yeah.
It's very much like Lichenambar sterisifluia. It has at least five lobes on the leaves. The seed heads are about the same shape, but much smaller, and can give fairly good fall color. I took a cutting of one I saw in Berkeley in the mid-1970s, and we have it at the Arboretum Nursery now, and it has a trunk about 2 feet through now.
Hmm.
And it gives fairly good. I saw it because it had purple fall color, and we've never done anything with it commercially, but it's there to be looked at. And it usually has an abundance of multicolored leaves in the fall as well. And, of course, the biblical association is of interest to a lot of people. The medicine was considered a salve for wounds and sores. So it was used a lot in the ancient times. And the one native to North America is similar. The one from Taiwan, a note that I see there is that there is a silkworm that feeds on it and produces a silk called Marvello hair. Now, how's that for trivia?
That's trivia.
That's trivia, but kind of interesting, I think. And then there is one other species, Lichenambar acalycina, which is from southern China, and it's similar to the Formosana that it has the three lobes. But all of these trees are useful. The hardiest one would probably be the Lichenambar sterisifluia, although the Lichenambar orientalis would be right behind it there in hardiness. Lichenambar sterisifluia, the wood is used in building and carpentry. One of my uncles, who had an underground house in Ontario, Oregon, The paneling on his house was liquid ambar wood called satin walnut is the name in the trade. And it's a beautiful kind of honey-colored wood. So it would take big trees to make that, but they can get big. This big deciduous trees have been used for medicine, for carpentry, for a long, long time.
Many years ago, I wrote a newspaper column that I called Back 40 Trees, trees that are best set way in the back of the yard. And leading that newspaper article was the liquid amber, because it can, the roots can crack driveways or walkways. the root system can heave pavement. And those seed pods can puncture bicycle tires. So you don't want to drive near it or walk near it. But it's beautiful to look at in the distance. Maybe have your neighbor plant one where you can enjoy it.
Especially if your neighbor waters his or her yard too much. Because it is a tree that likes irrigation. It's a good tree for the edge of a lawn where you're going to be doing watering anyway.
Yeah.
Although, not so good for the bare feet, I must say.
True. But still, with the fall color, it's kind of hard to beat. The liquid amber, I'm sure there's one near you.
The most likely is. One of the things, too, is that the leaves don't all drop at once. And as the leaves thin out, you get this wonderful pointillist effect of remaining bright leaves up in the tree. Altogether a very beautiful tree in fall.
And a rather interesting looking trunk as well. So it really does have year-round interest.
Yes, I think so. And also, you know, you catch people calling it a maple, and you can say in a nice way, well, it looks a bit like a maple. It's actually liquid ambar.
Yeah, and just call it its thug cousin.
Yes. And not for maple sugar, but for an antiseptic healing balm.
For when you step on one of the burrs.
Oh, ouch.
Ouch. All right. It's the liquid amber, and Warren Roberts is with the UC Davis Arboretum and Public Garden. He is their superintendent emeritus. The Arboretum is a wonderful place to visit any day of the year. You can find out more information when you visit their website, arboretum.ucdavis.edu. Warren, thanks for the liquid amber tree.
You're welcome, Fred.
Don't forget, if you want to learn more about the topics covered on today's episode of Garden Basics with Farmer Fred, please subscribe to the free Garden Basics newsletter. It's on Substack. Details are in today's show notes. The Garden Basics podcast will be on its winter schedule from November through January, which means there will only be one episode per week during this three-month period, and it'll come out on Fridays. Garden Basics with Farmer Fred is brought to you by Smart Pots, and we thank them for their support. Garden Basics, it's available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and leaving comments. We appreciate it.